don't skip your child's recommended vaccines. Talk to their doctor about how to stay up to date and help protect them.
A public service announcement from Vaccinate Your Family in collaboration with Merck.
Take your favorite non-commercial radio station with you wherever you go with the WHFR radio app, now available for free in the Google Play Store. After installing the app, you can listen to WHFR live to your Android device anywhere in the world. There are also articles posted by WHFR staff and the latest updates to the WHFR schedule. WHFR to go, free delivery, now available on the WHFR app and the Google Play Store.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists.
Happy summer. Welcome to this edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here along with Alan Mazurek. And we are so hopeful that you are listening to this conversation in a very comfortable environment, whether it's in a home, a car, or just with a little fan, you know, heading over your face. We are so excited to have you here today and welcome to WHFR Radio and the WHFR Journal. This is our local news and views talk show where we have the opportunity to connect with both campus community and community at large, people that are moving and shaking to make the world a better place. And it is our pleasure to indicate that this show is certainly no exception to that. So to our listeners that catch us every week, we are glad you're back and we thank you. And to those that are enjoying us in sort of our new environment of just the greatest sounding signal since we've done some upgrades, welcome to WHFR's Journal. We're so happy to have you here. Alan, we have been celebrating an awful lot these past few months. It seems like, you know, every month there's something important and profound to celebrate. We had, related to our discussion today, in the month of April, we had Campus Pride Month. And as we move into June, we have Pride Month. And I know that means some different things to different people, but I think the word pride is pivotal. You know, who wouldn't want to feel that emotion of pride? It's a very profound, powerful, I think, and beautiful thing. But related to that, the concept of using pride and using this time to reflect on some things that that we need to get better at as a society, and that we need to support and allow others to feel the sense of pride that they do, whatever that might mean to them. So let's just jump right in. We have had a couple of special guests on tap for previous conversations, but for some reason, this feels more necessary than ever. So I'm gonna get in here and introduce the guests today. We have Beth Preston joining us from Henry Ford College's SAFE organization, SAFE at HFC. It's a faculty and staff LGBTQ+ group of allies and community members designed to help spread awareness and make this campus community the best it can and the most inclusive that it can for all its stakeholders. So Beth, we're so happy to have you here. And Beth was kind enough to bring with her Troy Gibson, who is very, very involved in the organization, the student organization called SAGA. The SAGA stands for the Sexuality and Gender Acceptance Club. It is a club, student-led group whose mission is really to support students in their lives as LGBTQ+ individuals and allies. I've used the word pride. I've used the word allies. I've used the word celebrate. So we could take this conversation in a number of ways, but I suppose we'll start by welcoming our guests and also just talk about why these celebrations. Why are months dedicated to things that are as important as gay pride, as inclusivity, as the need to come together as a human race? And so Troy or Beth, who wants to start with that one?
All right.
Oh, well, I'll let Troy go.
Oh, well, I believe that pride is based upon not only the present, but the past. And with the past, you have to look at who stood up for gay rights, LGBTQ rights. And you have to look back at 1969 at the Stonewall riots. A group of people refused to stand down and stood up for their rights. 1978, you're looking at Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay man to be elected to a political office. And then you continue to go with 1996, where Hawaii, a judge in Hawaii, declared it illegal, not allow same-sex marriage. And then continuing on to 2015 for same-sex marriage legalized across the United States. And so these are reasons to celebrate Pride, and that's who we are, okay, is the accomplishments since the Stonewall riots of 1969, the accomplishments of the LGBT community and their allies. So that's the reason why celebrating Pride means so much to the LGBTQ community.
I think it's also, Troy, important that we acknowledge the shift in attitudes people seem to be expressing within our country, if not across the world, where they feel emboldened to share perspectives that it's okay to limit people's human rights. We're seeing this in states like Florida and Texas. The rhetoric of people thinking it's appropriate to go to Pride events to disrupt them and cause riots and harm individuals. We see this in the rise in number of violent hate crimes targeting our transgender communities, particularly our transgender people of color. And we know in the work that we've been doing over these several years here at Henry Ford College, how crucial it is that people feel seen and valued and safe and welcomed on our campus, that they know that regardless of their sexual orientation, gender identity, red hair, freckles, whatever it is, that they know that they are accepted and valued here as hugely important members of our community. And as a result, we need to learn how to better ally and advocate for these communities who don't have the same power and privilege that we have. And so, absolutely, we need to remember those who have gone before us, who sacrificed, in some instances, their lives so that we can be standing here speaking openly and proudly about our LGBTQ brothers and sisters and family. But we also have to be aware that there's still work to be done, and we need to do it.
In using the term ally, Beth, I recently came across the term when the college put out a call for some what they call ally training, which I know your organization is involved in coordinating and facilitating. So it sounds like what you're both saying is, even if you are not directly impacted as an LGBTQ plus member, but and maybe even not having a family member or a best friend or something, but this really is something that everybody needs to be able to wrap their heads around. And everybody hopefully will have buy-in and acceptance and that very important term of inclusion related to it. So becoming an ally sounds like it's the right thing to do just at heart, but why is it even more important than just, I feel good. Yes, of course I support people in different, you know, circumstances. So why do I need to train on it? Well, I just know that I'm a good person and I don't judge and blah, blah, blah. But we know it goes a step, multiple steps further than that. So tell us exactly what's involved there.
Well, you know, for me, it's a journey of learning. And that one of the primary components of being an ally is always educating yourself because things change. I can share with you on Facebook, I put a post up that says if somebody says doesn't love you because of you're gay, I'll be your mom. you know, and that I'll love you and I'll be there for you. And a friend of mine reached out to me and said, who is part of the LGBTQ community, said, you know, I know that you're well-intentioned when you say that, but I also want you to realize how painful that is for me to hear, having been exposed to a not accepting family, and that perhaps there has to be a better way to say that. And so being an ally doesn't mean you know everything there is to know. In fact, I think it means quite the opposite, is that you're going to be continually on a journey of exploration and trying to learn how to best help people feel welcome and included in the conversation. And in a lot of ways, that means stepping aside and giving them the platform to speak and share their truth and share their lived stories. And so we need to learn how to do that, not just for our LGBTQ students, faculty, and staff within our community, but for any group or individual who doesn't feel seen or valued, who feels marginalized, or that they're on the peripheral and that they don't have a voice, or that they don't necessarily matter. The reality is everybody matters, and everybody has a voice, and everybody should have the ability to be seen and valued and have their opinions and their feelings and their beliefs taken into consideration, and to not feel that they've been othered or outcast.
Yeah, excellent point. Ally training is taking place this coming Monday, actually, by the way, or this phase of ally training, Monday the 20th. If somebody connected to our campus wanted to get involved, and I know it is either in person at the college or virtually, although we won't get the lunch that I read about, so that's unfortunate. how can someone actually register for that? And is it too late to do that, this being, you know, 3 days before?
No, we actually still have some in-person seats available. So if anyone's interested in participating and learning more about allyship and or advocacy and how to be a better ally, they're welcome to send me an email directly at empreston@hfcc.edu, and I will reserve a seat for you in person. Or if you want to go to the Safe at HFC page on the Henry Ford website, there's also a link if you are more comfortable attending virtually. We're going to live stream the event. We're not going to record it. We are hugely respectful full of people's privacy and their right to anonymity. We realize it's a safety issue in some instances, and so we want to be respectful of that. But there will be a lot of great information being shared about how to respect people's identities, how to make space for people, and how to be inclusive. And then we're also going to be given some real life scenarios, and we're going to discuss how we could handle those situations and ways we can improve.
What I want to circle back to something Troy had said earlier, which, you know, I mean, also the idea of celebration in Pride Month as well. What is the balance like between, as you had mentioned, all of the accomplishments that have been made, all of the work that is still left to be done? And obviously this applies, you know, in so many areas of life as well. But for this particular month, for Pride Month, you know, from where you were going with that, you know, what is that balance like, I guess?
Well, That's a great question. I guess the balance is really enjoying where you're at. It was nice to see this last weekend with the Pride Fest downtown at Hart Plaza in Detroit. That was a great, I know many people showed up to that. It's great to see food trucks and rainbow flags flying and things for sale down there that had to do with the LGBTQ community and their rights. It's a narrow path that you walk when, especially like Beth had said, with Florida and Texas and legislation that's coming up to try to rejoice in being in Pride Month. But at the same time, realizing that there's always a struggle. We're always going to be struggling because no matter what you do, you're always going to have certain people who feel this way. Okay. But with the ally training, hopefully you can at least get those people to understand that this is a population of people who are here at Henry Ford College no matter what. I think Beth, with your leadership and with the Safe at HFC and Saga Club for the students, we have found this is a medium that we are able to come to at Henry Ford for students and for faculty to feel accepted, feel wanted and needed, and that our viewpoints matter.
One of the things that Beth mentioned, that I appreciate you sharing that personal story about writing something on your Facebook page and then having someone sort of take a little bit of a twist on it and say, I know you're trying to help, but maybe consider this. You're right. We are all learning. And I think as terrible of an excuse this is, I've heard it. I maybe have used it once or twice, not quite knowing how to handle. So not quite knowing, is this going to be offensive? Do I say this? I don't, there's so many different letters. I don't know how, I don't know what to say anymore, kind of a thing. And I know not everybody can or necessarily is interested or suited for something like an ally training, but just as human citizens, you know, just as people, if we could only have everybody follow that mindset, just be kind, I think most of this stuff would go away. But we know that's not the world we live in, unfortunately. But what, you know, when we talk about, let me step back. I had students in one of my classes write some essays about the story of them and how they see themselves represented in media and film and books and stuff. And if they don't, why do they think that is the case? And what does their story look like? It was a really profound series of essays that I got from this particular group this semester. And I learned things. I always learn things from those. But one I learned was that one of the students is a Muslim young man, dual enrolled, who happens to be gay. And he said it's hard enough to be gay, but to be Muslim and gay is like the worst kind of a thing. And I was, you know, feeling his truth and also, of course, sharing resources as an instructor I would do, and as a caring human being I, of course, would do as well. So that was one of them. The other one was an African-American young man who indicated that he is bisexual and talked about how he doesn't fit the stereotype. People that find out that he's gay, well, you're not flamboyant, and come on, where are all your female friends, and why don't you dress like this? And he's like, no, I'm just under the radar. I'm just being me. This is me. I don't have to fit that stereotype. So I guess where I'm going with those two examples is that there really is no bucket to put people into, nor really should there be, because that is ever changing anyway. But what do you say to people that take that step back and say, okay, too much, can't deal with this, not interested, can we all just get along and let's just be done with this?
Well, you know, I had someone say to me that they didn't understand why I was so driven about this, and that it seemed to them that it was better to take the stance of, well, let's say that I'm colorblind. I don't see color. We're all the same. Well, my comment back was, the reality is we're not all the same. We're all different. And it's actually those differences that make us special. And if we try to cover those up or ignore those unique parts of who we are, then we lose parts of ourselves. And really, it's the differences that are make us vibrant and give life texture and color, and I'm running out of adjectives, fabulous and special and all of these things that add to the brilliance that is our world. Why would we want to live in a muted, single tone world when we can be surrounded by the vibrancy of all the colors and all the things that make us special? And why would we want to pretend and live in a life where we're not authentically ourselves? So really, you're doing yourself and others a disservice to say, oh, I can't take the time to bother learning all these things. And really what it comes down to is respect and, yes, kindness. I try to treat people the way that I hope people treat me or my children, and that I try to create a world that is accepting, because I want to be accepted, because I have things that make me different. I have times when I don't feel part of it. So why wouldn't I want to diminish that for other people who also feel the same way? I don't know if I answered your question, but, you know, I think it's important. We have to try to make a difference.
Final thoughts, I guess, to both of our guests today on that. And what do you think? Are we heading the way we need to be heading? And it sounds like we've got some great things ahead.
It was really good to walk in actually to Myers Thrifty Acres here and find that they had a whole, actually a couple racks full of rainbow hats, rainbow t-shirts, rainbow flags for your house. And it was actually nice to be driving through a neighborhood where I live and see rainbow flags flying for the first time ever. So you're right, Susan. I do think that is definitely a step in the, and you're seeing more and more of it at different stores that I would have never thought in years would ever carry anything like that. And Myers being one of them, it was nice to walk in their door, and right there was the stand, and then in back of it was more rainbow stuff. So that was great too. But at the same time, I think we still have a battle in front of us to make sure that we continue to cut down legislation that inhibits people's rights to be an individual and to love who you want to love.
And that's somebody who grew up in the 70s saying Myers Thrifty Acres. I do have to say that.
Yeah, yeah, noticed that as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Beth, what are you celebrating this month then for everything we're talking about?
I'm celebrating the fact that people feel freer to express their pride than they have in many years, for several years now. I am seeing a lot more pride flags. I was on Amazon recently, actually earlier today, if I'm telling on myself, looking for stuff for the ally training, and went down a rabbit hole of pride stuff because each new page looked better than the first. And I could have easily spent my entire paycheck there. It just was thrilling to me, and just to see the support from the President of the United States supporting our LGBTQ population from the moment he took office, seeing our governor and attorney general at the Detroit Pride events, that just made my heart sing. Working with a young lady who lives in Ortonville, Michigan, which is a fairly conservative part of our state. She came and spoke to our committee and students about her Pride event called Abigail's Pride, and to see that there are young people who feel empowered to fight for what they believe in. It makes me hopeful in a way I haven't been hopeful in the past. And I am looking to the future and am confident that together that we can make a difference and we can make this world a place where we're proud to feel safe and protected. And I'm forever always thankful for my friend Troy.
Is there anything about the resources and things available on campus and the programs that you're involved in that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to mention?
Well, the Safe at HFC page has a plethora of information. So there's information about gender-inclusive restrooms that are on campus, and I'll say Henry Ford College, as a community college, has some of the most gender-inclusive restrooms of any community college in the area, which we're very proud of. We also include LGBTQ-specific scholarships for students so that if they're struggling with resources, they can hopefully apply for and receive scholarships to help support them on their journey. One thing that's not on the SAFE website, but I know personally because I'm a financial aid administrator here at the college, that if you're a dependent student and you no longer have parental support, you've been kicked out, or you find yourself homeless, please connect with me. I might be able to assist you with what's called a dependency override, where you can then qualify for federal financial aid. Many students whose parents kick them out don't feel like their parents, that they can get federal financial aid because their parents won't help them. Well, guess what? We can do a workaround so that you can get and qualify for money that can help keep you in your classes so that you can work towards your degree and maybe even have some extra money to help with housing and transportation. So there's, I can't speak highly enough of our page. It has a tremendous amount of resources. It has external resources like food pantries and homeless shelters that are within a 9-mile radius of the Henry Ford Dearborn campus. So that can be helpful. And hotlines, you know, we talked about the suicide hotline, but there's also other crisis hotlines that are listed there for elder individuals and just a number of other resources. So please take a look there.
Thank you so much. We are so grateful for what the two of you and your teammates do through SAFE and through SAGA and our students as well, certainly. I know that none of this would be happening without your commitment and dedication. And I'm encouraged, based on some of the things that you said, that the school is hopefully looking at maybe doing some expansion, and certainly with our strategic plan, that's a big win for everybody, certainly. So I'm appreciative of you mentioning that as well. But Beth Preston, Troy Gibson, we hope that you will continue to celebrate all of the good things that we can through Pride Month, and every month should be Pride Month, of course. But let's take that special spotlight and do the best we can with it, and continue to get the word out about all the wonderful things that are happening on our community, in our campus, and also in the bigger picture, while being mindful of knowing that there's still things to do, and there's a fight yet to be fought, and one probably going on at all times. So Ellen talked about that balance early on. Hard to say, and it's probably going to ebb and flow a little bit as the days and weeks and months move forward, but I feel
more confident knowing that the two of you are at the helm of this very, very important cultural and human situation to allow us to be better every single day. So thank you so much for your time today. We went a little over than we expected, but what powerful information. So thank you and keep up the good work.
Thank you both for being with us. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek along with Susan McGraw. Always a pleasure to spend a Friday afternoon with you here on WHFR, the station making waves.
Start your Mondays here at WHFR, 10 a.m. until 12 noon with the White Rabbit. Diving down that rabbit hole with his hot wax radio. Here at the station that's making waves.
This is why you work so hard to pay the mortgage. Because home is more than four walls and a roof. It's that porch swing and a summer evening. It's everybody over for Sunday dinner. And your family sleeping in their own beds at night. Making Home Affordable is a free government resource that can make paying the mortgage easier. Call 888-995-HOPE or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov.
Good night, Mama.
This is Why. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek here until 2 o'clock today. Kitty Love will be along at that time, bringing us a trip down Highway 61, some blues for our Friday afternoon here on WHFR. Well, of course, as we continue with Pride Month here for a few more weeks, we also want to turn our attention to another celebration going on this month. And this, of course, taking place over the course of this weekend, the newest federal holiday, Juneteenth. To explore a little bit more about Juneteenth and its origins, we turn to the podcast Making Contact and their program From Juneteenth to Reparations, The Freedom Promise of Unfinished Resolve. Lots of stuff to celebrate here in the month of June here on the WHFR Journal.
This week on Making Contact.
When peace come, they read the Emancipation Law to the colored people. They, the freed slaves, spent that night singing and shouting. They wasn't slaves no more. That's former slave Pierce Harper talking in 1937 and recalling what happened in 1865 when the slaves in Texas learned that they had been freed, emancipated 2.5 years earlier by Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So certainly the singing and the shouting and the celebrating of those slaves happened quite late.
Juneteenth, also known as Juneteenth Independence Day or Freedom Day, is the oldest known celebration commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. Dating back to 1865, it was on June 19th, Major General Gordon Granger came to Galveston, Texas, to inform a reluctant community that President Abraham Lincoln, 2 years earlier, had abolished slavery in the U.S. and to comply with his directive immediately. I'm Anita Johnson, and this is From Juneteenth to Reparations, The Freedom Promise of Unfinished Resolve on Making Contact. In this show, we'll trace the history of Juneteenth from the late 19th century freedmen colonies and settlement celebrations. Presented by Dr. Shanette Garrett Scott, a historian of gender, race, and capitalism, she shares a history of the African-American narrative that's rarely explored.
The end of the Civil War did not immediately come to Texas. I mean, it was June 2nd, 1865, before the Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith finally surrendered to Union forces in Galveston. So slaveholders in Texas really refused to acknowledge that the war was over, and they refused to give up their slaves. Now, holding on to such a fantasy, I know you're probably thinking, how could they continue to do this? But it really wasn't as hard as you would think. That's because Texas was really kind of insulated during the Civil War because of the Confederate blockade. There weren't that many battles that happened in Texas. So the Texas was really shielded from the brunt of the Civil War. In fact, slaveholders, especially those in Mississippi and Louisiana, would bring their slaves to Texas to hide them from the oncoming Union lines. So at the end of of the Civil War, there were untold, you know, thousands and maybe tens of thousands of slaves that were added to the 180,000 slaves that were already living here in Texas. So Union Brigadier General Gordon Granger, and that's his picture there at the bottom, arrived with about 1,800 Union troops at Galveston in mid-July. Don't really know the exact date. But on June 19th, Granger made news of freedom official. He stepped onto the balcony of Ashton Villa, which was the former headquarters of the Army of the Confederate States of America, and he read General Orders Number 3. And this order informed the slaves that the war was over, and that they had been freed by Lincoln with the Emancipation Proclamation 2.5 years earlier. Now, the reactions of these newly emancipated slaves was mixed. I mean, you had some people who stood in utter disbelief. People shouted prayers to God, but most sang and danced right there in the streets. So I want to take a moment really to correct some misconceptions about emancipation. Now, it is true that Texas slaveholders and Confederates had suppressed news of the Emancipation Proclamation that went into effect in 1863. But the truth is really that the Emancipation Proclamation really didn't free that many slaves. It didn't free the vast majority of slaves. First of all, it didn't even apply to the border states, the slaves in the border states that stayed loyal to the Union. And then, of course, the USA could no more dictate, you know, what the Confederate States of America did with its citizens than Jefferson Davis could command Lincoln to leave the, quote, peaceful and contented slaves alone, lest he incite them to a general assassination of their masters, end quote. But more important than all that, the slaves did not wait around for a proclamation or a piece of paper to say that they were free. Between 500,000 to 800,000 of the 3.5 million slaves, they ran away during the Civil War. They freed themselves. They did not need a piece of paper or someone coming to tell them what they had come, what many African Americans had come to know, that this war was a war of freedom and emancipation, that it was about slavery. Now, these runaways, they ran to the north, but many of them ran to the Union lines right there in the South's backyard. And many of them set up camps and they started free communities. And those who didn't run, we're already shifting, you know, the power dynamics on the plantations and the farms throughout the South, including Texas. So therefore, Africans were already forging these new visions of freedom and citizenship long before General Gordon stepped onto the balcony of Ashton. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that Juneteenth is not important. It is, because with that announcement, it was only then that Texans were forced to finally acknowledge that African-American men, women, and children were now free and that they were no longer property. And the word spread quickly. Some people stayed put. Others left immediately. They wanted to get away from their masters. Many wanted to find family members who had been sold away. Some people went north. Some people even left the country. So June 19th became Afro-Texans' new Emancipation Day, or Jubilee Day, as it was often called. Now, the first Jubilee Day celebrations took place, of course, right under that Ashton Villa balcony. The first official celebrations began in 1866. And from the very beginning, the Black Church, which was the most important independent institution in the African-American community, was really central to those celebrations. And in the 1860s, at Peyton Colony, which was a freedom colony in Blanco County, the Baptist Church there held a special Juneteenth service. And then the children marched in a circle from the church to the school, to the cemetery, and then back to the church, and kind of a symbolic reuniting of the free living with the deceased and unfree ancestors. They even had fireworks. So they created these by cutting holes in trees, and they filled them with gunpowder and set them on fire. So by 1870, in Texas, there were nearly 50 freedom colonies, or these settlements of emancipated African Americans. And there were hundreds of them, but 50 of them were located near Comanche Crossing in Limestone County. And the largest and most popular Juneteenth celebrations occurred right there. So African Americans also celebrated in communities in Texas City. In Texas cities, and Austin and Houston especially were very popular. They even purchased land, creating these emancipation parks to hold their Jubilee Day celebrations. Now, there are not a lot of scholarly sources on Juneteenth, but a few people who talk about it mention that they start using the term Juneteenth instead of Jubilee Day after 1900. But in my research, I've actually found that it was in the early 1890s, as early as 1891, that African Americans in their communities were calling Jubilee Day Juneteenth. And Juneteenth, of course, it's obvious. It's just June and 19th, where they cut out the 9 and they squeeze the June and the 10th together. So by the early 1900s, Juneteenth celebrations had spread from Texas to southeast Oklahoma, to southwest Arkansas, and parts of Louisiana, and they rivaled Independence Day celebrations. So now, to people looking on the outside, they probably saw these people celebrating and eating and playing games, and they thought of them as these kind of just jubilant celebrations that took place on one day a year. But during these celebrations, especially in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s, blacks were talking about their political rights. They even had politicians, people running for local governments and state governments, come to the Juneteenth celebrations and picnics and stump to get the African American vote. They encouraged blacks in attendance to register to vote, because freedom included the right to vote. And it was, that right was slowly being taken away during the last decades of the 1800s. And of course, it was completely compromised by the early 1900s. Now, Juneteenth can really teach us not just about the past, but it's also important in our more recent history, society and politics and culture. So if we just look at it inside American history, instead of something that happens parallel to or outside of U.S. history, then we get a deeper meaning out of what some would consider a hidden history. For example, in the late 19-teens to the 1930s, those large-scale, community-wide Juneteenth celebrations actually became less frequent. So people continued to celebrate, you know, in their homes and in their churches and in their communities, but those really big county-wide celebrations, like the ones at Comanche Crossing, really became almost non-existent. And so I had to ask myself, well, you know, why is that? So I thought, you know, about looking at the period, what was going on in America at the time. So by World War I, the late 19-teens, segregation laws firmly in place. There was this tide of nativism that was engulfing the country. And so for anyone who doesn't quite remember what nativism means, that means there was this rejection of outsiders, this fear of foreigners. So I think that combining segregation, racial discrimination, with this xenophobia and nativism, led many whites and even many blacks, African Americans, to see Juneteenth as un-American. Un-American because it focused on this dark period in American history. It was precisely at the time that the United States was trying to show itself as this global power, you know, on the world stage. And so, ironically, therefore, Juneteenth was considered unpatriotic, that celebrating it showed that you were disloyal to the United States. And that time, not only did it commemorate this really dark period, but those were also some dark days at that time, because this was during the Red Summer, which was a wave of deadly lynchings and race riots that occurred in the United States from 1919 to 1921. But, you know, Juneteenth is a spirit of freedom, and it refuses to just die. So there's this renaissance that comes in Juneteenth that occurs shortly before the United States goes to World War II. And the really important catalyst for this renaissance happens right up 75 in Dallas, Texas. So you have Antonio Maceo Smith. He's an educator, and he's head of the Dallas Negro Chamber of Commerce, and he's trying to lead efforts to create this commemoration or an exhibit of African-American life and culture for the Texas sesquicentennial in 1936. Well, the state fair organizers refuse. And so Smith does not give up. So he goes over their heads to the federal government, and he actually secures a $100,000 grant. And he uses that money to build the Hall of Negro Life on the state fairgrounds. Now, local white leaders protested the construction of the hall, but there was nothing that they could do. It was completed, and it was dedicated on Juneteenth, 1936. And so over 46,000 African Americans streamed into the state fair grounds for the largest Juneteenth celebration ever held up to that time. Now, the hall, unfortunately, was demolished soon after the fair closed, but that spirit, that rekindled spirit, they could not destroy that. And so then it was after 1936 that the Juneteenth celebration was revived in these more public commemorations. That's because African Americans now were emboldened because of their success during the centennial. And also, this was in the 40s, you had World War II, and African Americans were fighting for what they called a double victory. So there was a victory over fascism abroad and a victory over racism at home. And so these Juneteenth celebrations in the 40s and the 50s really highlighted this idea, rekindled this idea of equal rights. They would also honor former slaves and African American veterans. Now, during the civil rights movement that really started to kick off in the mid-1950s through the 1960s, many blacks really were more conscious, you know, about drawing the connections between their present day movement and their ancestors' historical struggles for freedom and for equal rights. So in debate and reactions surrounding the Civil Rights Act, many made the explicit connection between that act and fulfilling the freedoms that were first guaranteed in the Emancipation Proclamation, and that the Juneteenth general orders showed this deferred freedom. So President John F. Kennedy mentioned the Emancipation Proclamation in a speech calling for federal civil rights legislation. And after his assassination, LBJ pushed through the bill. And one of his aides told him, quote, "It's equivalent to signing an Emancipation Proclamation," end quote. So the deferred freedom that was celebrated during Juneteenth speaks to this struggle for equality and rights that continued through the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the activists in the 1960s clearly made those connections to Juneteenth. And organizers of the 1968 Four People's March held a Solidarity Day rally, and they held it on Juneteenth, 1968. And African Americans attended from all over the country. And so after they returned home, they either revived or they initiated Juneteenth celebrations in their hometowns around the United States.
You're listening to From Juneteenth to Reparations, The Freedom Promise of Unfinished Resolve on Making Contact. To find out more about this week's show, check out our website at radioproject.org. Sign up for our podcast or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Coming up, we'll expand our conversation of Juneteenth to include a case for reparations. Next, we'll hear from attorney Fania Davis as she explores reasons for the U.S. government to reckon with and compensate for centuries of stolen labor and legal oppression. As the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign cycle ramps up, Democratic presidential candidate hopefuls vying for their party's nomination are taking positions on the issue of reparations for slavery, elevating the discussion to the mainstream. Fania Davis was one among a panel of scholar activists who described some of the experiences under which Black people lived during and after slavery and recounted examples of what reparations could look like. Making Contact producer Monica Lopez brings us these excerpts from a panel recorded this spring at Mills College in Oakland, California.
Fania Davis worked for 30 years as a civil rights trial lawyer and later in the field of restorative justice with youth in the schools and in the juvenile justice system.
That work arose from my origin story, having been born in Birmingham, Alabama, which we called Bombingham, Alabama, during the height of segregation and the height of the movement resisting it. I was born on Dynamite Hill. That was my neighborhood. Homes were bombed in our neighborhood because Black families moved in pushing the color line. So that experience growing up in apartheid and, going to stores where we couldn't be served and being called derogatory names and being insulted every day and being exposed every day to the pervasive social messaging that Black people were subhuman, in addition to the racial terror, is what set me on this path of being, in many ways, a warrior for social justice. And in later life, after so much fighting and anger, both as a trial lawyer and as a street activist, I had some experiences which made clear to me that I needed to bring healing energies into my life, and that was my attraction to restorative justice, which is based on indigenous healing and peacemaking.
Slavery existed as an institution in the United States for nearly 2.5 centuries. When former slaves were finally emancipated, Jim Crow laws ensured that the segregation and unequal treatment of African Americans would continue for about another century until 1964 and the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Over the years, there have been symbolic gestures and some tangible offers of redress. In 2008, the U.S. Congress offered an apology to African Americans for slavery and Jim Crow.
First, I just want to say this is 2019. It's exactly 400 years. The first African captives were kidnapped and brought to this land. And I just want to speak that and name that 400 years. And the reparations movement, quiet as it's kept, has been going on for about that long. And finally gaining a little traction after all those years. So the apology in 2008, important. However, in the restorative justice movement, we say it's not just about saying sorry, it's about doing sorry. I remember one of the elevator women during the Kavanaugh hearings said that she had serious concerns about Kavanaugh as a Supreme Court justice, because for her, justice was recognizing that pain had been caused, taking responsibility for the pain that was caused, and number three, working to repair the harm, the pain that was caused. The first actual reparation effort that's recorded was by an African-American woman who was freed after her slave master left the country. He was Isaac Royall, and in fact, he was one of the main founders or patrons of Harvard University. Isaac Royall was a royalist. So when the war was lost and the Americans won and the British lost, he fled to the Caribbean. And one of his slaves, Belinda, proffered a petition claiming that she was entitled to reparation for the many, many years of labor, and she won. And then after that, there were Quakers who insisted that the Quakers could not own slaves, and they needed to free them if they did own them and give them reparations. And then you had General Sherman after 1865, after Emancipation Proclamation. There was a Field Order Number 15 that said that the government would give a newly freed slaves 40 acres and then later a mule. And some African Americans did actually receive that, but very, very short-lived. As soon as Andrew Johnson came, who succeeded President Lincoln, the special order was repealed. And one I forgot that just occurred. Georgetown students voted that they would pay reparations to the 272 descendants of the slaves who were sold to keep Georgetown from going bankrupt. There was a commission that was formed to study Georgetown's complicity with slavery. That was a couple of years ago. They identified, as a result of this research, 272 descendants. And now they're in the process of talking to these descendants to discuss what reparations might look like. And they've already started to offer legacy admissions to descendants of the 272. I think some descendants want a Truth and Reconciliation fund, and that they have not agreed to that as yet. But the students, you know, just did a really, this is historic what they've done. And, you know, there's the Chicago Torture Reparations Fund, where the government, I don't know exactly how much, but more than $5 million, I think considerably more, I'm not sure, to survivors of black families who were tortured and brutalized and terrorized by police. And that reparations fund involves creating a trauma center and offering trauma services, job training, income supports, housing. And then in Charlottesville, there's also a reparations fund. It's about $4 million, I believe. But even though it's small, it offers some glimpse into what a macro scale reparations might look like. There are income supports or checks, you know, like Jews get checks, but it goes beyond checks. That's not nearly an individual compensation is important, but supports for housing and education and parks and scholarships and supports for youth are part of that Charlottesville Reparations Fund.
There are many ways in which reparations may be made, and Germany, says Fania Davis, offers examples of how that country has made reparations for the Holocaust.
Germany, as I said, started with checks. Now, Germany has done an incredible work, especially in the education area. They have completely transformed the curricula to require that the Holocaust be taught not just in history or just in sociology classes, but in music classes, in art classes, in every single course, every child in a public school in Germany must learn about the Holocaust. And every year, teachers are given continuing education so they can teach more effectively. I think we can definitely learn a lot about that. I saw a U.S. News and World Report front page that said that only 8% of high school students in a study knew that slavery had anything to do with the Civil War. So the first thing that needs to be done in any campaign, a strategy for reparations, is truth-telling. Like I mentioned earlier, universities are starting to do that, and many white individuals, growing numbers of white individuals, are starting to do that. That's really, really important. And then, you know, taking responsibility, saying sorry and doing sorry. Fundamentally, any reparations movement must be anti-capitalist, because that's where all of these pervasive human rights violations, the genocide, the slavery, and all of the afterlives of slavery, it's the colonization and conquest of peoples of color, Asia, Africa, Latin America. That was all ushered in by racial capitalism. And we say racial capitalism. There's no such thing as just plain capitalism. It's racial capitalism. because there would be no capitalism without Mississippi. Manchester, yes, England, but you know, there would be no capitalism were it not for cotton. It's and were it not for all of the conquests in third world countries. And so we've got to figure out how to completely transform our society, our government, our schools, our economic system. That needs to be a bottom-up, participatory, grassroots process. But one of the things that we really can't do, in my view, is to have a process that's dominated by experts, and that's a top-down process. The last thing I'll say on this question is we need a healing component. The trauma resulting from genocide and land theft and forced assimilation and the Indian boarding schools and slavery and convict leasing and lynching until today, you know, with mass incarceration, the school-to-prison pipeline and the immigration oppression that we're witnessing. And it has really hurt us, all of us.
That was Fania Davis, social justice activist, civil rights trial attorney, and restorative justice practitioner, speaking as part of a panel on reparations at Mills College in Oakland, California. Special thanks to KLW for permission to use the recording of Fania Davis. She spoke on a panel about the multicultural dimensions of reparations. Again, you've been listening to From Juneteenth to Reparations, The Freedom Promise of Unfinished Resolve on Making Contact. Special thanks to Allen City TV in Allen, Texas, for permission to excerpt the recording of Dr. Shanette Gerridge Scott. This is Making Contact, and I'm Anita Johnson. Thank you for listening.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.